Today, a different way for believers to see natural evil in the world.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Every three or four episodes, we like to step back from the other issues that we deal with, talk about on the podcast, and instead just examine a scripture, a passage of scripture. And because I've been working through the Psalms lately myself, we are usually venturing our way into one of these poems. And so Psalm 29 is the one we're looking at today. And Psalm 29 invites this conversation about natural evil, not because I need to hijack the psalm and give it over to a philosophical question. In fact, we don't do that. By staying with the psalm, you'll see that we gain a completely different perspective on how to approach something that would be in the realm of natural evil. And when I describe that, even when I say natural evil, I think there are a lot of people who would say, yeah, what do you mean by that? Well, we usually bifurcate evil into two different categories. Hence, bifurcate. But anyway, into two categories, moral and natural evil. And it's the thing about moral evil that sets it apart is that it's intentional. It's created by the action and choice of a human being. So a murder is a form of moral evil. Theft is a form of moral evil. Lying is a form of moral evil. So, you know, a moral agent perpetrates the evil in some way or another. But then there's natural evil also. And natural evil is the stuff that happens coincidentally to human beings. So a rock rolls over on a car, or a flood drowns someone. And the consequences are the same. Death, suffering, sorrow, loss, somehow undermining the stability and comfort that we thought we had in the world. So that's what I mean by natural evil. It's that stuff where the rocks just fall down. So it's neither an etymological nor psychological accident, it's not a coincidence, that some of the most awe-inspiring occurrences in nature accompany some of the most awful things in human experience. And you could use any example. The 2004 tsunami that brought so much devastation in parts of Asia. The seasonal tornadoes that happen all the time, that break out all the time in the United States. The tightly spun hurricanes that bring so much destruction to whatever area they hit, or the broader, more open hurricanes, which may not reach Category 5, but bring destruction to such huge regions of the country. Those coming ashore any given year are a form of natural evil, earthquakes, and all kinds of devastations that just take place in nature, what we're talking about. And what we won't address today, and I should soon in a different episode, what I won't address today is why God would allow something terrible like that to happen in nature to a circumstantially innocent or even virtuous or heroic person. Because things like that do happen. And when I say circumstantially innocent, I mean in the same way that Job was a righteous man. It's not as if he had never committed a sin, but he never did anything that brought about the response that came to him when Satan brings all these destructions into his life. I mean that kind of person. I mean a person like, and this happened recently as you're listening to it, I don't know when it would be to you, but as I'm recording this just last week, National Guardsman Bishop Evans from Mansfield High School from Arlington, Texas, where I grew up, he died in the waters of the Rio Grande River only because he was trying to save some other lives that he saw were in jeopardy. And It is a tragic loss. It's a form of evil in the world that a person who's trying to do good would then be drowned in the waters of a river. And things like that happen all the time, of course. So today's psalm, what it invites us to do is not just address this philosophically, but more in light of our covenant and our relationship with God. It invites us to see the powers which can rightfully be so terrifying to us in this world. It invites us to see those powers from a completely different perspective. And so what I want to do is just take the psalm and read it to you. I'll read it in the ESV. And there are some phrases in here that could be translated differently. We're not sure exactly how to translate them, which way to go. But I just want to read it to you directly, and then we'll go back and talk about it phrase by phrase, or at least stanza by stanza as we go through the message of it. So this is a psalm of David, Psalm 29. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. There is in this psalm, as we read through it, you'll notice these appeals to the majesty and the power of God above, but then directly in the power that he reveals through most likely just a description of a thunderstorm that's going on. And so he says, ascribe to the Lord the glory due to his name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. The voice of the Lord is above the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord over many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. The Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf and Syrian like a young wild ox. The voice of the Lord flashes forth flames of fire. The voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The Lord shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord makes the deer give birth and strips the forests bare. And in his temple, all cry, glory. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as king forever. May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. This is a fantastic psalm, a majestic, powerful psalm, and it appeals in such poetic language to images that we can identify with, even with a few references we may not identify right away, but are really easy to spot so that we understand what's going on. And we may not get the fine nuances of how David is appealing to a pagan religion in some of their myths, but I think it's obvious that in appealing to just a few of those things, we can grasp what's going on in this psalm. So let's just start out by taking it stanza by stanza, sort of section by section. The first section that shows up is this appeal for the heavenly beings. And we'll talk about what those are, but these B'nai Elohim, the sons of God, to lift their voice to give God credit for something. So the voice of the other beings, the other heavenly beings, are the first things that come up. And it's in this first section, the first two verses. Ascribe to the Lord. It's really just give to the Lord. And it's not a donation. It's not a gift as a present. It's giving credit to him for what's his. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings. And these references to the Lord are references to Yahweh, not a generic God, not a generic mighty being, but Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings, ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. And we'll come back to that strength shortly. Well, shortly, you know, at the end of the psalm. We'll see how quickly I can get there. Ascribe to the Lord, it goes on in verse 2, ascribe to Yahweh the glory that's due to his name. Worship Yahweh in the splendor of his holiness, in his majesty. And so the interesting thing about this is because we know that later in the psalm, he's going to appeal directly to the way people from Tyre and Sidon, people from Lebanon, would refer to regions of the area. So Mount Hermon, for instance, is referred to in the way that a person from Tyre or Sidon would refer to Mount Hermon later, Sirion. So we have a sense that he's saying this so that the people in Israel who are reading it, who are obviously going to bring this up in the temple for reasons that we'll talk about later, who are going to use this form of worship in the ultimate sign of their covenant with God after David is gone and Solomon has built the temple, that Israel would think of those cedars of Lebanon, which themselves are also mentioned. So he seems to be describing this in a way that has him looking at this powerful storm that God is bringing down on a foreign land, not on Israel, but on the lands that surround Israel, but in a form that they're familiar with, that they would see from Israel or in Israel itself. And I say all of that because this statement, ascribe to Yahweh, you heavenly beings, and the B'nai Elohim and the sons of God appearing before the throne of Yahweh as they do at the beginning of the book of Job, appear often to be a way for Israel to refer to the nations around them and say, you think your gods stand before the throne of the one true God, Yahweh. But regardless of how you refer to your gods, because, and remember, if you're uncomfortable with this language, remember that Paul himself says there are demonic, he would say, beings, and of course we agree with Paul, he's inspired by the Holy Spirit, there are demonic beings who are behind these false gods, behind these Baal images that the people in the land surrounding Israel worship. So it's okay that he refers literally to B'nai Elohim. Everything's created by God, including the evil forces. So that he would say this and use language that in the lands around them and in the people of Israel would bring a remembrance that the nations around them think of their gods as standing in the heavens around the throne of the one true God of Yahweh, that he would say to those gods, bow down before the one true God, bow down before Yahweh. I'll make clear why I'm saying that in a moment, but the obvious example of it, the obvious reason for it, when David, and again, this is a psalm of David, that when David would say, ascribe to Yahweh, you other heavenly beings. Ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. Ascribe to Yahweh the glory that's due to his name because he reigns with splendor and holiness. It's obvious that David would appeal to something like that because he reigns just after this incident takes place. Remember when the Philistines have captured the Ark of God. And we'll talk about what ultimately happens with the Ark and David's reign in a moment. But remember, the Philistines, before they even have a king, while Samuel is their leader as the final sort of judge prophet of Israel, before Saul is even appointed as the king, anointed as the king, when the Philistines in 1 Samuel 5:1 capture the Ark of God in this battle that they're having, and they carry it away to Ashdod, right? So the Philistines took the ark, and I'm reading it for 1 Samuel 5 right now. Listen to parts of this story. You'll remember it as I'm reading it to you. When the Philistines took the ark of Yahweh, of God, and brought it into the house of Dagon. So they bring it into a different temple to say, oh, we have our God, and we'll just add your gods to this panoply where we have all of the gods, you know. So they brought it into the house of Dagon, and they set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, I love these stories, behold, Dagon had fallen face down on the ground before the ark of Yahweh. And so they took Dagon and they put him back in his place. And, oh, well, that's not the place for a god to be, bowed down before the God of the Israelites, Yahweh. And so they took Dagon and they put him back in his place. And when they rose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground again before the ark of Yahweh and the head of Dagon. And both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him, just this stump, to remind them that he is just a stump of a god compared to Yahweh. And so this is why the priests of Dagon, I love this this sort of superstitious practice that rises up after that among the pagans, the non-believers in Yahweh, that the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon don't tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. By the way, I have to do this. I have to interject that I walked through the hallways one time and passed by David Brooks. You'll remember David Brooks. We did an interview with him early on in the podcast. It was an early episode, and you can go hear that episode at barrycreamer.com. Look it up wherever you listen to them. And so it's called Rare and Unresearched. That's the title of the interview I did with David Brooks. But long before that happened, we were just walking past each other in the hall, and I said to David as I was passing by him, how's your day gone? And he said, oh, well, it's fallen down and lost its palms and head before Yahweh. David is an Old Testament professor. He tells bad puns like that. But that one was a good pun. How's your day gone? Fallen down before Yahweh. Come on, that's pretty good. Anyway, every time I read the story of Dagon, I remember that. And I appreciate David Brooks for bringing it up. But it's a great story about these other claimants to the throne of God having to fall down before him and ascribe to Yahweh, O heavenly beings. Do you hear this? Ascribe to Yahweh, Dagon, glory and strength, because only he holds all of this true power. And so after that happens, you'll remember the sort of passage of the ark from Ashdod to Gath and Ekron and Beth Shemesh, and finally, it ends up in Kiriath Jearim. If you don't remember that story, you know, the people there are afraid of it, and so they send it off to Ekron, and in Ekron, it ends up that the people all get these boils that come up on their bodies, or these, you know, swellings that come up on them. And so they want to get rid of it, and they put it on a cart and send it away, and it finally comes to a place that belongs to Israel in Kiriath Jearim, as it's called at the time. And it's from there that David, the author of our psalm, you know, David, takes the ark and begins to bring it back to Jerusalem. And even he, on the way to Jerusalem, remember, is when the ark falls over and Uzzah puts out his hand to touch it, and Uzzah is slain. And David laments the death of Uzzah, and it's called Perez Uzzah, you remember, and it stays in a man's house until they can finally take it after a few months when the Lord is blessing that man's house. They finally take it after a few months back to Jerusalem where it belongs. David knows this story. He's the one who brings the ark back. He understands what's been happening when the ark of Yahweh is put in front of others that we all have to bow down before this presence of Yahweh and acknowledge that he's the one who has all of this power. And so it's not surprising that David would write a psalm. How he does this and whether he has this in mind or not, that's all between him and you, him and the Lord. Nobody will ever know but he and the Lord. But for us to read it and not remember that that's present in his history, for him to put before us that when other gods, when other heavenly beings, when the B'nai Elohim are in the presence of Yahweh, they bow before him and ascribe to him glory and honor. Regardless of how it relates directly to the story, we have to recognize the value that brings to us as we recognize what Yahweh is going to mean to our voice, what we're supposed to do later in the psalm. So now in the first two voices, we have this understanding of how the other gods should respond to Yahweh's voice. So we start with the voice of the other heavenly beings in the presence of Yahweh. Now we get Yahweh's voice. So you gods should ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength and the splendor of holiness. Yahweh's voice, what does it do? So we start in verse 3. The voice of Yahweh is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. And of course, David knows the thunder itself is not the voice of Yahweh. But in the metaphor, he's writing a poem. In the metaphor, what a magnificent image of the voice of God. This sound of the rumbling thunder coming down from the mountains. And him saying, Yahweh's voice is over the waters. And the God of the glory of glory thunders above all of the waters that we see. The Lord, Yahweh, over many waters. The voice of Yahweh is powerful. The voice of Yahweh is full of majesty. And so when he's saying he's above the waters, it's not just a statement that he is above the oceans or he's above the streams and the rivers. Because he says he is the God of glory is thundering and he's over many waters and that the power of his voice is over all of the waters and full of majesty. you know, we're reflecting on Genesis 1 when God is saying, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and in the creation, he separates the waters from the waters and makes an expanse and separates the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that are above the expanse. And it was so, and God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning. There's the second day. And so now they have an understanding of where the rains come from the waters that are above the heavens. So no surprise then that David would look at this storm and say that God is above all of the waters that are above, the waters that are below. They are all beneath the hand and power of God, who has all of this majesty that we should be ascribing to him. So the voice of the Lord, the voice of Yahweh, which he's using a metaphor as a metaphor, the thunder to represent, the voice of Yahweh, he says in verse 4, is powerful. The voice of Yahweh is full of majesty. So he's responding to this powerful storm by saying, now you can understand how high and how mighty the voice of Yahweh is, and therefore how high and how powerful Yahweh himself must be. Then we get to verse 5, and we have another little section about the voice of Yahweh and what it's doing in this metaphor of the storm coming to represent the power of God that David is describing. So in verse 5, it is, the voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars. So these magnificent trees of Lebanon, and he'll refer to them as being in Lebanon in just a moment. So these are the magnificent, powerful trees with which they build their most stable, sturdy, strong, majestic buildings. These are the pillars, the structures on which they're willing to build the society that they're establishing, the culture that they're establishing. And he says, the voice of Yahweh breaks those cedars. That's how powerful it is. The Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon. He makes not just the cedars of Lebanon with which we're willing to build the greatest structures we're going to build. He doesn't just break the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon itself skip like a calf. And if you've seen a calf skip, you know how light, how joyful a thing like that is. And because he uses such a light image, just a fleeting, momentary image, a calf skipping through a field. And he says, when the Lord is thundering, the ground itself, not just the trees that are so powerful we can build our buildings with them, but the ground that holds those trees through the entire region itself is no more than a skipping calf through a field. This is how powerful the voice of Yahweh is. And so he makes Lebanon skip like a calf. Syrian, Mount Hermon, if you've been on Mount Hermon, if you've been to Israel and seen Mount Hermon, we're not talking about, you know, a little mountain next to, it's not a little hill, it's not, this is a major mountain. It is the kind of thing you approach and you drive up, and when you do, you look over to the side, and there are peaks over here and peaks over there, and you can't see the peak of this mountain, and it's covered in snow when you do see the top, and it's an overwhelming, it's a Rocky Mountain, Colorado-type ridge of mountains that comes to a peak in Mount Hermon. So when he says Syrian skips like a wild ox, he's saying the entire land around us, the region itself, shake. So it's a redundancy. I mean, it's an emphatic redundancy of what he says when he makes Lebanon to skip like a calf. He makes this entire range of mountains, Syrian, to skip like a young wild ox. This is how powerful God is as he speaks through this storm. You know, when you look down one psalm, and I'm only doing this to make the point that David writes psalms that sometimes are associated with the temple, even though he doesn't get to build the temple. But remember that what motivates him to build the temple, which is often referred to as the house, when he's able to build the house, the bait, when he's able to build the temple, when he wants to build the temple, God doesn't allow him to do it. And we all remember why, and I won't go into all of that. But he does build his own house. That's what provokes him to want to build a house for Yahweh. Here I sit in this magnificent house. I should build a house for Yahweh. And then Yahweh says, well, you know, why do you think I would want a house from you? But your son, I will allow to build a house. That temple, right? So the superscription to Psalm 30, that little title that comes at the beginning of some of the Psalms, is a Psalm of David, the very next Psalm, a Psalm of David, a song at the dedication of the temple. Well, this is the temple being called the house. So it's possible that David does write the Psalm that comes next, Psalm 30, actually for the temple, that he doesn't get to build. He doesn't get to use the psalm in that temple, but Solomon, his son, will build that temple, and they will worship with these psalms that David writes in the temple. So it's very possible that even Psalm 29 is written with the temple in mind for reasons that I'll mention but won't go into in detail in just a moment. But it's certain that he writes some of these psalms in a way that most people would read as implying they're going to be used in the temple that's going to be built, the temple where the ark that he brings back to Jerusalem is going to end up residing. So through one king after another until it's finally taken out in the destruction of Jerusalem. So Psalm 30's superscription brings us a recognition that this might be about the temple, but it also does something else. That dedication, at the dedication of the temple or the house, reminds us that David's house, this magnificent house he has built for him, that Hiram of Tyre up in Lebanon sends the cedars for, the same person who's going to send the cedars for the temple when Solomon is building it, that those cedars that David is singing about in Lebanon are the same cedars that provide the house in which he lives and the house to which they will go to worship Yahweh. And so in 1 Kings 5, we're told literally the cedars of Lebanon, the temple is built of the cedars of Lebanon with the skill of the people who live in Sidonia, in the regions around Tyre and Sidon in Lebanon, what we refer to as Lebanon. And they're the ones who call Mount Hermon Syrian. That's their name for that mountain. So for him to be referring to these cedars of Lebanon and the mountain as Syrian, in a home built where they have stability and safety in this house built of the cedars of Lebanon that have been taken down and given to Israel, fits perfectly this image of Yahweh standing before the gods of the region and the gods of the region having to bow down before him. So that in verse 5, when the cedars of Lebanon are broken, they are bowing before the God who will be in the temple, which is constructed of those very cedars, so that Yahweh only is exalted in Israel. And even the house that David lives in, even if it's not about the temple itself, just the house that David lives in, where the Lord says, you know, those cedars that we took down in Lebanon, they stand around you to indicate the safety, the blessing that I provide for you. This is part of the image that's going to come later in the psalm. It's going to be obvious, but I think it's introduced there, with the cedars of Lebanon being taken down and God shaking the lands that are around them. Lebanon skips like a calf, not Israel, not Mount Zion. Lebanon skips like a calf. Syrian skips like a young wild ox. Israel, Jerusalem, no, they're not fazed by it. And David writing this psalm in a house of the cedars of Lebanon makes perfect sense. Verse 7, the voice of Yahweh flashes forth flames of fire. The voice of Yahweh shakes the wilderness. Now this time, the Lord, Yahweh, shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. So Kadesh, remember, is this place where Israel congregated as they were leaving Egypt and trying to decide how they would come into the land of Israel. So, whether David is writing this with that Kadesh in mind or not, because there are different places that people say are Kadesh, and there might be a northern Kadesh or whatever, doesn't change the fact that the word that's used is in reference to this experience in Israel's history that they're going to identify with as they read this. Let me read to you how it's described in Numbers 13:26, so you can recognize this and following. It says, when the spies came back, they came back to Moses and Aaron. Remember, they sent the spies into the land. Tell us what it's going to be like. Come back. Tell us how we'll conquer the land, so on. When the 12 spies, one from each tribe, came back, and you'll remember Caleb and Joshua, the only two good spies who say, no, we can take the land, right? That's this story. So in Numbers 13:26, it says, when they came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the people of Israel, they came to them in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. This is where they are when they hear this news. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation. They showed them the fruit of the land, and they told them, "We came to the land to which you sent us, and it flows with milk and honey. This is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in that land are so strong. The cities are so fortified, and they're enormous. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak, the giants. They live in that land." So in that land that's so powerful, in that land where the giants dwell, there comes this sense that the people who surround Israel, the people who occupy the land where Israel is, who dwell among the Jews who are there in Israel, David in his house, Israel worshiping in the temple after David's death under Solomon's reign, that they're so mighty. How could we ever conquer them? Well, of course, they know their history. They know how God does conquer them. And so David creates this image to remind them that even when giants occupy the land itself trembles before Yahweh. And so he reminds them of Kadesh, and he says, "The voice of Yahweh flashes flames of fire." I know we think of lightning as electricity, but that's Ben Franklin and forward. Fire descending from heaven is lightning. That is the image. So this thunderstorm comes, and David says, "Oh, I remember how much more powerful Yahweh is than all the mighty things we thought filled this land. The cedars of Lebanon, look at these huge trees, the abundance of wealth, the giant cities, the giants themselves, the descendants of Anak who live here." And he says, "I remember one thing that was bigger than that, Yahweh and everything he does. So the voice of the Lord flashes forth flames of fire. The voice of Yahweh shakes the entire wilderness." Yahweh shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. So whether he's saying from the north end of Lebanon to the south where Kadesh is, or if he's saying from the mighty powers that intimidated us to a storm that rightfully threatens us, our God is greater than all of those things. He's certainly appealing to that truth that Yahweh is above all of those powers, whatever they are, in verses 7 and 8. And finally, we get to verse 9. Now, I say finally, in this little section about Yahweh's voice, it's the main section of the psalm. And Yahweh's voice finally does this, the voice of Yahweh. So there are two ways to take this phrase. If you take it most straightforwardly from the text as it's been handed down to us in Hebrew, according to all the translators, the major translators, then you would translate it as, it makes the deer give birth. And so that to me, that makes sense. You can read it that way, and it makes perfect sense in this context because it gives reference to the animals who are there, and then it gives reference to the trees that are there because it says, the voice of Yahweh makes the deer give birth and strips the forests bare. I think it's a way of saying, because remember, birth and fertility are a mystery to these people, and they are looking at the power of God. And remember, the gods that are bowing down before Yahweh to ascribe to him glory and strength are mainly gods of fertility in their land. They're gods who rule over the forces of order and produce fertility for them. And so for those gods to bow down before them and for Yahweh's voice to be uttered and the deer are, you know, giving birth would make perfect sense. It's that terrifying a storm. So the deer just producing offspring, and the trees are being stripped bare at the same time. He strips the forest bare. That would make perfect sense. It'd be fine. Most of the translators, I'm not going to say most because obviously it's split even between the ESV and I think the NET version, for instance, which is more of a dynamic translation. They take a little more liberty with using text criticism, and there's an argument for doing this. I'm not criticizing it. To translate it instead as bends the giant trees, because you can make just a tiny change in how you vocalize the Hebrew in that section, and instead of it saying the deer give birth, it says it bends the giant trees. And that makes a lot of sense in context of this psalm, because everything else has been about this storm coming down the mountain, and the only references to animals have been metaphors for the land itself. The land is skipping like a calf. The mountain is skipping like a young wild ox. So, you know, I don't know which one it is. They both work, but either is going to lend the same image to us. which is the voice of Yahweh, is so powerful. It is bending the trees or terrifying the deer or producing this greatest of mystical powers on the mountain of the deer giving birth. But I'm going to say bending the giant trees right now. It's bending the biggest trees that are up here and stripping the forest bare. This is the image of the power of Yahweh being given to us in verse 9. And that statement is enough. Now, I didn't finish verse 9. There's one phrase left, but we have to separate it from the others. It's the conclusion to the entire section. I wouldn't separate it in terms of the intent of the entire section, but it's no longer about the voice of Yahweh. So I want to separate it. We'll talk about it in just a moment. But if we stop right there and strips the forest bare, then I can't read this psalm. Every time I read it, I remember this, without thinking of a time I was on Baldy. So for those of you who've ever been to New Mexico, what used to be Glorieta, now it's a different campground. I don't know, it may still be called Glorieta. There's a city right there next to it, or a little town, a village, hamlet, I don't know, something right next to it, called Glorieta anyway on the map. And so if you've been to Glorieta, there's a mountain called Baldy, and you hike up Glorieta Baldy, is how we referred to it. And it's a long hike. You know, you hike miles and miles up the mountain, and it takes most of a day for me. I guess there are some people who could do it in a couple of hours or maybe 4 hours, but 2 hours up and 2 hours down, something like that. But for us, it took most of the day. So we'd hike up in the morning and try to have a snack at the top, hike down again. And so we had hiked up, and we just, you know, I mean, when it's a beautiful morning and there's no breeze and the sun is shining and the butterflies are flitting, you know, you just think, okay, I'll throw in some water and a sandwich and we'll hike the mountain and we'll be back later this afternoon. When you get to the top of the mountain and you look down from it, and there is a ranger station on the top of this mountain. I mean, it's a high mountain. It's a high climb. So when you get to the top and you look down the mountain and you go, wow, that is cool, and what you see is a thunderstorm coming up the mountain, it is impressive. And then it is terrifying because it's like, oh, man, it's not here yet. I'm not even sure it's to the campground we're going to try to get to yet. So, I mean, we can't wait here. We'd be here all day, and then it'd be nighttime, and then we wouldn't be able to find our way back. So, I mean, we're hiking back anyway, so here we go. So you hike back, and I remember getting maybe an hour down the mountain, maybe 30 minutes down the mountain, and we started getting hit by rain, but you could see it was really dark off in the distance and coming toward us, and so it just starts getting worse and worse. There's a little bit of rain, it's sprinkling, pattering, and oh, so happy, look at the squirrels. And then it's sprinkling harder, and then the big drops start hitting, but they're intermittent, and then there are a lot of big drops, and then we're slogging wet, and then we're noticing that there are little bits of hail starting to fall. And it's like, oh, well, I wish I'd brought some kind of protective gear. I've got nothing. Well, let's find a place to hide. In the Rocky Mountains in New Mexico, where there's nothing but straight up vertiginous, granted, but straight up pine trees with no protective limbs on them whatsoever. There's nowhere to hide. There are no rocks to hide under. There are no caves to get in. And who wants to get in a cave with all the animals that are up there? There's nowhere to hide. So it's like, what? Where? I just hope it doesn't. And just like that, the storm blows over and the hail never gets worse and we're fine and dandy. And it's like, well, I knew we were okay. That was no problem. That was cool, wasn't it? In the moment, I remember it was terrifying. What this experience is like for David as he describes, and remember, this is a man who has lived in the woods. He has stayed in the woods with his army. This is a person who understands what it means to be outside and experience the power of nature and the consequences that can come with it. And he writes this entire psalm in a way to evoke in us that sentiment that we have when the trees are bending over to the ground. The wind is blowing in such a way that you don't know if you're going to recover from it. The fire is falling from heaven, and the sounds of God's voice are permeating everywhere you are because of the thunder. In that setting, this is the conclusion David draws, that when we hear the voice of Yahweh over the waters, when we hear the voice of Yahweh shaking the ground, that our response is that all who are in his temple cry, glory. glory and strength go back to him. In verse 1, remember, ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings, you other gods, Baal, bow down before the Lord and ascribe to him the glory due to his name, the splendor and holiness that's his. But the first statement, ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. And so now it's not those heavenly beings, it's Israel, the sons of God, the people of his covenant. Ascribe to the Lord glory. And in the power of his majestic storm that he's brought on the mountain that rightfully terrifies us, all who are in his temple now, a temple built of the cedars of Lebanon, which God can strip bare in the presence of all those false gods who claim to have such power in the world. When God demonstrates his power, he strips those cedars bare and he stands them up in his temple. And before him, all cry, glory only to him. Mirroring the command of the heavenly beings, acknowledging his power in verse 1. David, whether it's David in his house or the people of Israel later as they sing this psalm in the temple, it's the same. David is safe in his house constructed of the cedars stripped from pagan Lebanon and brought to Israel to provide him, and by inference, Israel, with shelter. The storm that so strips the land provides him with shelter. And so we end the psalm in verses 10 and 11. We end the psalm with what's above and below the voices that are crying out. So in verse 10, Yahweh sits enthroned over the flood. It's no longer about the waters. It's no longer about the storm. It's no longer about the thunder. It's no longer about the voice of Yahweh. It is Yahweh himself. Yahweh sits enthroned above all of this, above the flood, above the water that's descending, above the thunder, above the lightning. Yahweh sits enthroned over the flood. Yahweh sits enthroned as king forever. The flood could refer to the worst of times. You know, when the flood comes, Yahweh is still king. He sits enthroned over the flood. It could refer to, you know, Noah's flood. And they certainly know the story, and they can certainly apply it to that. The flood could be the downpour from the waters that are above the firmament, both bringing Noah's flood, but also bringing this tumult that David is observing and using as a metaphor to describe God's power descending in this thunderstorm. It could be the downpour from the waters above the firmament. And so the thing to observe is that the storm that's so intimidating, so overwhelming, so terrifying to everyone else is to us comforting. Since the God who created and called us created all the things we fear, God also creates the things that intimidate, that overwhelm, that terrify those who seem so much greater than us. And so by the time we get to verse 11, the very end of the psalm, the last verse, and he says, may Yahweh give strength. Remember, this is the same strength that the heavenly beings are to ascribe to Yahweh in verse 1. The same glory and strength that we ascribe to Yahweh when our voices rise in the temple to acknowledge that all the power is his. That we ascribe strength to him makes sense. But what it says here in verse 11 is, may the Lord give strength to his people. Not ascribe strength, but give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people. And then this crazy ending to this psalm about the power and destruction of the might of God's voice being used in this world. He concludes it with the word shalom, with the word peace. That's the end of the psalm. And here's the point that I'm trying to make. Majesty, and this is just in verse 11, may the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. Majesty and power are already entirely Yahweh's. With our voice, we acknowledge that truth. We confess that majesty and power belong to Yahweh. So with our prayer, may the Lord, may Yahweh, may our God give strength to his people. May Yahweh bless his people with peace. So with our prayer, with that prayer, we're simply asking God to rain down on us the waters so universally already under his power. That is, that he would flood us and equip and protect us with his strength. That he would flood us with the peace which comes from his authority being revealed. And by its nature, when he blesses us with peace, he pours that same peace in a worldwide flood that's just as overwhelming as the flood of Noah. By appealing last to peace, to wholeness, the psalmist David is asking the God who floods the world with his terrifying displays of power to bless his own people so that there is an equally powerful flood filling this world with peace.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.